So, now with great pleasure I introduce today's speaker. David Beauchamp is an associate professor in the School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences. He's also the assistant unit leader for the USGS Washington Cooperative Fish and Wildlife Research Unit. He received his PhD here at University of Washington in Fisheries. He was a staff scientist at UW and a technical consultant for Northwest Native American Tribes for 3 years. He also held postdoc and faculty positions at Utah State before coming back to UW. His research looks at quantitative food web dynamics, which is a fascinating area of study, and he's worked on most of the major large cold water lakes in the western U.S., Puget Sound, and Gulf of Alaska. With that, let's offer a warm and enthusiastic welcome to Professor David Beauchamp.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you braving the elements to come here today. So hopefully we'll make this worthwhile. I'll have to give a bit of an abbreviated talk, I guess, because I would stretch it to the whole time, so I'll just get started here. I tend to work in food webs, and it's got quite a bit of application to management, and what I hope to show you here is how that all comes together. The key theme here is that biotic interactions are really essential part of the aquatic environment there. And so when we think of the quality of a habitat, it's not just the physical portions of the habitat, the structure that we can see, the water quality that's there. Those elements provide the potential for sustaining and supporting aquatic life, but it's really the biotic interactions that are going to determine just how much productivity you get, and particularly for specific species that we may be interested in, like endangered fishes or sensitive species, or those that have some sort of social or economic value to them. And biotic processes, I'm talking about things like the food supply through time and whether or not that food supply is accessible by the consumers. Also, that can be compromised by competition from either other species or too many of the same species. And then predation can be a major source of mortality that could regulate a number of populations. And so we need to consider all those things within the context of what constitutes viable habitat for a species. And so I'd argue that the current push for habitat restoration, conservation, those sorts of strategies need to explicitly incorporate food web processes into their strategies there. Well, here's a local example of a food web, and what I want to show you is that from a distance you can see lines of various heaviness that connect different species together, and the thickness of these lines indicate the strength of that interaction. In other words, in this case, here's a predator, a cutthroat trout, feeding on juvenile sockeye salmon, longfin smelt, three-spined stickleback, and a number of other species. And you can tell from, if you had a food web diagram like this, you could quickly narrow down the scope of the 40 plus species that are in this lake down to just that number of species that are the real essential players in here. You may modify that list somewhat by those species that have particular interest, again, because they're on an ESA list or something, such as these juvenile Chinook. But this helps you to focus on those interactions that are most likely to have an influence on the structure and function of this ecosystem. I want to give you just a few characteristics of large western lakes, and this also transcends into rivers and marine environments too to some degree. First of all, when we talk about fish, these food web processes tend to be very dynamic in time and space both. You've got the availability of prey that fluctuates on a seasonal basis. It can also fluctuate in terms of its access on a daily basis during day and night periods. The consumers can move between habitats quite a bit, and so they can either homogenize their experience across this whole set of resources, or they could stay in one location and have very localized effects and have a very localized experience as well. The other thing is that you've got a broad range of sizes from nearly microscopic, or let's just talk about something about 1 millimeter in size for prey, up through animals that are sometimes a meter or so long. And so you've got several orders of magnitude in terms of the size relationships. And even those big predators start as very small animals, and so they have to grow through this gauntlet of different life stages, and so they may occupy different locations in that food web where they start as prey and grow into predators. So all these things become essential in looking at how these systems interact. The other thing that's very common out west is we don't have a lot of species compared to other parts of the continent and maybe other continents as well. Glaciation really minimized the number of species we have. And so as a result, there's been a number of non-native species that have been either introduced on purpose or accidentally have come in or have invaded. And they tend to usurp some of these key roles in an ecosystem. Sometimes they take over the role of the top predator. Sometimes they compete with species that are beneficial or desirable in a system. And here's just a list of some of the common cast characters that we see out in Western Lakes: lake trout from the Great Lakes, mysid shrimp also from the Great Lakes. Kokanee sometimes are spread around in different places, brook trout and brown trout. We get to these warmer water species like bass, walleye, shad, and sunfishes, and also crayfish that can be in colder or warm water environments. In the marine systems, we have similar analogs there too, and you may be aware of the concern about ballast water bringing invasive species from the bacteria up through zooplankton level that can potentially have very profound effects on ecosystem structure as well. Well, I gave you a simplified food web diagram earlier, but again, you got to keep in mind that there's this temporal aspect. So if we look across seasons, you'll note that some of these interactions blink on and off, or they just increase or reduce in intensity. And so measuring these things or even detecting these links can be tricky. So you need to have some sort of a sampling mechanism that accounts for this seasonal variation in order to do that right. And again, as I noted earlier, the size of the fish, this is an adult cutthroat trout in Bear Lake. This is a juvenile cutthroat trout. They tend to have different positions in the food web, whereas these juveniles are victimized by predation, and they feed on different prey. Seasonally, they'll feed on sometimes entirely different food resources, and so these things need to be accounted for when you're looking at how a food web operates through time, particularly if you're trying to evaluate what the quality of that habitat is overall. Okay, the non-native species come in, and in this case, Bear Lake is on the Utah-Idaho border. These lake trout from the Great Lakes region have invaded, and they have assumed the role of top predator. We also have other non-native species here that exist in the lake, but they're somewhat marginalized in that they don't really have a strong ecological function. In this case, they're kind of on the fringe of their thermal tolerance. The types of habitats that are available for them are not great. So they exist, but they're not really playing a major role. And so if you're tasked with trying to understand a food web, you don't want to waste a lot of effort studying species that are going to be somewhat meaningless. You need to at least establish that they have a meaningless role out there, but you want to get to that point as quickly as you possibly can. So what you need to do is develop a fairly efficient filter to quickly identify which are the strong interactors and which are those that really don't have much of a role at all. Okay, so some questions that are very common when we think about how food webs operate. We want to look at what processes are regulating the production. By production, I'm talking about growth and survival, these processes that determine whether or not a population is going to grow or shrink and or sustain itself. So we're looking at the processes that regulate production and the distribution of these animals as well. Okay, so if we take this point by point, mortality is a key issue. That's the ultimate filter. And that can be caused by either predation, starvation, disease. We can come up with some other suspects as well, but that's a fairly good list. Growth, of course, you need food to grow, but you also need access to that food to grow as well. So it's one thing to have food in the same body of water, but it's another one to have that food located in an area that is accessible to your consumer. And then, of course, competition is going to shrink the size of the pie that's available to the consumers that are trying to feed on a common resource out there. Environmental stressors. Most of these animals in aquatic systems are cold-blooded, so temperature has a major impact on regulating their physiology and metabolism. And so the amount they can grow is determined a lot by temperature, But we have other stressors out there too. You've heard a lot probably about the hood canal hypoxia issue, where a number of species along the bottom, there's been mass mortalities periodically because the oxygen goes to zero. And then we have contaminants of all sorts that can be pollutants, it can be things like PCBs or mercury, the flame retardants, etc. A number of these things may have no real effect on the animals, or they could have debilitating effects that we're only now beginning to understand. Okay, and then what's our role in all this, and how does our role compare to what the natural disturbances are in this system here? We have natural invasions of species, but we also have a lot of introductions that humans are known for. Climate change, of course, is a big issue, and it's not going away anytime soon. But probably the biggest near-term effect that we're having on the environment is our use of land and water and how we manage those resources out there in terms of land development, how we decide to use water, partition it, et cetera. So those things all have a major impact on how a food web is going to operate and how an ecosystem in general functions. So the approach that we tend to take is that we need to identify and quantify the major interactions that are operating in these systems. We need to do it on both the appropriate scale of time and space, and ontogeny, which means the developmental life stages of animals. As they move through their life history, how does their role change, and how does that affect the overall structure and function of a system? I want to mechanistically link these animals based on the individual behavior and physiology of these animals. That seems like a tall task, really, if you're trying to go from the individual and scale all the way up to an ecosystem. But I think we've tried to take shortcuts over the decades many, many times, trying to find the silver bullet that's the easy way, and I think we've failed enough that that's gone into my decision to try and say, well, let's just roll up our sleeves and try and understand things as mechanistically as we can. Because the one thing that happens there is we can go back and anecdotally look at responses that have happened in the past, and we say, okay, this, we're coming onto some conditions that look somewhat similar to that. We might expect a similar result. Well, we're starting to get to these conditions that are beyond our previous experience, and so we have no anecdotes to go back to. And so I think we need to understand how a system functions in response to different sets of conditions mechanistically. That gives us a better sense of how the system ought to continue to respond as those combinations of conditions change. Okay, and so to do this, we employ a combination of simulation models and directed sampling, and occasionally we'll conduct the rare experiment, but in natural systems, that it's uncommon to be able to do that very well. So the tools that we're using to conduct this work are modeling, and we'll use a number of different types of models. The bioenergetics model is the one that I'll focus on mostly. What that does is it links the physiological responses of animals to how their environment changes in terms of the type of food they have available to them, how that changes through time, the temperature they're exposed to, etc. To become more predictive, we sometimes use foraging models, which say we climb into the heads of these consumers and say, what sorts of sensory mechanisms do they use to perceive their environment? And based on what limits or facilitates their ability to detect prey or predators, how does that change under different sets of conditions? And based on that, can we predict how whether they're going to do better or worse under a new set of conditions or not? And then because these populations are changing a lot, we need to understand something about the population dynamics of these animals. Okay, by population dynamics, I'm thinking of it fairly simplistically, just how do animals grow, how does their abundance change through time? But we need to keep track of that at some level in order to identify how these interactions change through time. Okay, now these models, we need to really tie them tightly to real-life data. We want this stuff to be realistic, not just theoretical. And so what we're doing is using a field sampling program that's directed explicitly at feeding the model with the types of information needs that it really has to use. And we can do that in a way that, with some flexibility, that says if we've got a season of the year, for instance, where conditions change rapidly, we can sample frequently through that dynamic period to capture those dynamics and feed that into a model. And other times of the year where you have more static conditions, we can be a little more lax about the frequency with which we're sampling. And the types of information that we're trying to collect are: how are animals distributed through time and space? How does their abundance change, either in a relative sense or an absolute sense? Sometimes it's very difficult to get at what the absolute number of animals of a particular species are in an aquatic system. But if you know whether they're relatively common or not, that's a first cut. And we can also do a number of intermediate cuts that I'll try and show you here that allow us to get around the real problem of trying to have absolute abundance estimates of these animals. Again, size structure, their age and growth, since that drives a lot of their trophic interactions, we need to know something about that. And then their trophic interactions directly, we can do this by examining the diets of these animals through time and as they grow. We can also do it with an integrative measure, looking at stable isotopes. And the value of the food that they eat, we can measure by calorimetry. By value of food, I'm talking about how many calories or joules are caught up in a unit weight. So if I had a pound of Twinkies in my hand here and a pound of lettuce here, one's going to get you a lot fatter than the other. Well, in the natural world, calories are life, and so the higher that energy source is, the better off they're going to be. And so high energy is highly desirable. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about the energetics model and what it can do for us. Again, it can quantify the linkages, but it does that by accounting for changes in the diet of these animals, the temperatures they're exposed to, and again, the quality of prey is tied directly to the types of organisms that they're feeding on. We can use that by quantifying those trophic interactions. We can start identifying which are the really strong interactors, and then we can identify whether or not there's actually ecological bottlenecks that show up in terms of, is there enough, maybe there's not enough food to get animals through a particular time of the year, or perhaps predation is creating such a mortality burden on a population that they can't really sustain themselves at a desirable level. Okay, the nice thing about this type of model is that it uses data that can be collected routinely in either a monitoring program or an expansion of a monitoring program out there. So there's nothing particularly special about the types of information that we need. What we do want to do, though, is customize how and when we're collecting that information. Okay, and then probably the most important thing is anytime you're dealing with a real complex set of questions and lots of different types of information coming in to support your answer, you need to have some sort of way to organize that information and decide how to use it. And so a model creates this nice conceptual framework for organizing that information and using it in a methodical way. It also helps us to identify those areas that we have less certainty about the information as it comes in. Rather than being paralyzed by that uncertainty, we can flag that and say, okay, we don't know as much about this. Let's proceed on, get our answer. But then we can go back and revisit that source of uncertainty and say, okay, how sensitive was our final answer to this uncertainty? We can explore the boundaries of how much that particular area or variable might have possibly changed. And if that results in a major change in our answer, we can say, okay, this was somewhat sensitive. We probably need to go back and do more work in that area if we have the wherewithal to do some additional sampling or additional analysis. Oftentimes, though, we'll find that some of these sources of uncertainty really have very little effect on the final answer. And so we can say, okay, whether or not we know this answer with 50% accuracy, 10% accuracy, or 100% accuracy, it really doesn't matter. We just needed to be in the ballpark there. And so that's a valuable way to be able to deal with your information as well. Okay, the energetics model in its simplest form, is it's just an energy balance equation. So the amount of energy that comes in has to balance the output, or that's the energy that the animal is using. And let me give you a representation of that. So this fish here is eating zooplankton. And then the energy that comes into that fish, or the food, is modified by the temperature the fish is exposed to, the body mass of that fish, the quality of that prey, and maybe some other stressors to determine how much of that is lost in terms of waste, how much is lost in terms of metabolic costs. After you account for those loss rates, whatever's left over is available for growth. Now, if they're in a deficit, of course, this animal is going to lose weight rather than gain weight, or it'll lose energy content. If we look across a range of temperatures that a salmon might be exposed to, for instance, this is for a sockeye salmon or a kokanee, its landlocked equivalent, and let's say over all those temperatures, this individual was had unlimited food supply. What we see, this curve here is the amount of food that it's capable of feeding on. And what you see is you have a dome-shaped curve where it can feed the most up at around 20 degrees centigrade, and then it drops off on either side of that. Now, the waste that they can't use tends to be more or less a constant proportion of the total amount of food. So if you subtract the waste, we drop from this black curve to this red curve here. Okay, so this is the amount of food after you've subtracted out the waste cost. It's still this dome-shaped curve. Now, respiration or other metabolic losses tend to increase more of an exponential curve here as temperatures increase. And so the distance between this green curve and this red curve indicates the amount of growth that's available for that animal if they're feeding at their maximum rate at any of these temperatures. Now, in nature, these animals typically aren't often feeding at their maximum rate, so maybe they're only feeding at this level here, and now we subtract off the waste. Now they only have between this point and this point to grow, and so that's obviously going to reduce growth. You can also have other stressors that increase activity or the metabolic costs that also impinge on the energy that's used by the body otherwise, and so now you've reduced growth even further. So if we simplify this and just show a graph of just the growth response now, instead of everything else, if you recall, the consumption, the amount of food they could eat, topped out at about 20 degrees. But in terms of growth, the top is right here. I know you can't see it very well, but notice you've got a fairly broad shoulder over a broad range of temperatures where they're feeding, they're growing at a pretty high rate based on the temperatures that they have. That's if they're feeding at their maximum consumption rate. Now, if all of a sudden their ration drops to about half of that, you see a big change. Certainly they're growing at a slower rate, but also the temperatures at which they're going to grow best are over a cooler range of temperatures there. And if you drop it even further down to just say 20% of their maximum rate, you see that the temperatures over which they have optimal growth decline much further. What's probably more important here though is that their thermal tolerance goes way down. So the temperatures at which they're not going to lose any weight jump from near lethal temperatures over here around 24 degrees down to around 17 to 15 degrees here. So when we talk about temperature, we really can't talk about it outside the context of the amount of food and the quality of food that these animals are exposed to. So we can use these sorts of relationships in a modeling context to ask all sorts of questions here. And so in practice, we can take a model like this. It has all the physiology for an animal already embedded in it, and we're just simply trying to solve this equation here. And the most common way to do that is to ask the question, given an observed growth rate here, how much food had to be consumed in order to satisfy that growth? You can turn that question around and say, if we knew consumption, how much growth could occur instead? And so if we do our sampling, we're trying to provide the thermal experience, the diet composition as it changes through time, the growth of that consumer, and the energy of both the consumer and its prey, which we can get from literature values or measure directly. And that will output something on how much food they were able to consume on a daily basis, so that we have the ability to look at a fairly fine time scale how these processes change And that gives us an advantage when we try and identify these things. So I just wanted to, with that background, give you some applications of this model. We can look at carrying capacity of a system and whether or not that's mediated by competition, either by more of the same species or other species. We can look at predator mortality, again, consumption by predators on their prey. We can look at how the growth potential may change through time and space for a particular organism, given the change in conditions, whether the food supply varies or temperatures vary. And we can do that to compare different types of habitats. For instance, this has been done when restoring salt marsh channels in some of these estuaries along the Pacific. They can look at whether or not some channels have a higher energy benefit to young salmon than others might. You can also look at how species introductions have an impact on the environment. Ideally, you'd like to do that beforehand so that if this was a proposed introduction, you could talk to the managers and say whether or not this is going to have a benign effect or it's going to have some major impact on the existing community or not, or be highly beneficial. Again, climate change. Also, bioaccumulation of contaminants, because we're modeling how animals consume and what goes into their consumption rate, we can model how they accumulate different sorts of toxins from the environment, and then also nutrient recycling. Okay, I'll give you a couple of local examples here. In Lake Washington, there's a sockeye hatchery to try and enhance the sockeye salmon population in the system here. But there was a concern that the winter carrying capacity of the lake might be exceeded by adding more fish to the lake. And then there's another issue that's important for juvenile salmon in general, particularly Chinook salmon, about whether or not mortality imposed by predators was a major source of mortality regulating these populations. Okay, again, here's the Lake Washington food web. We're going to focus mostly on these predators and this pelagic environment in the second example. The first example deals more with these planktivorous fish. These are ones that are feeding mostly on zooplankton here, mostly out in the open water environment. Okay, and so we're interested in the food demand and supply of sockeye salmon fry as they first enter Lake Washington. Okay, the idea here is that these sockeye migrate from the Cedar River into Lake Washington in February through April, when this is winter conditions, so food supply is pretty low. Now the concern is if these fry remain down in this area here under already low food conditions, we'd have these localized depletions of food, and you'd have even lower growth rate and perhaps lower survival as a consequence. Also, the study coincided with a period when we had the highest fry production in history, so it was a good test of the system overall. Alternatively, perhaps these fish, rather than remaining clustered down here, would distribute themselves throughout the lake and avail themselves of a larger pool of zooplankton rather than just eating out of that one little fishbowl down in the bottom of the lake. So to attack this question, we need to know something about their distribution. So we can use hydroacoustics. It's just a fancy name for sonar. But what it does is allows us to measure the density of animals at different depths in the water column, and it also partitions those densities into different sizes of animals. But we don't know what the species composition of those, because we have different species that are the same size, and so you can tow a net through different depths in the water column as well, and that gives us the partitioning of the different species that goes with that quantitative estimate of the density or abundance of fish that are at each of these depths. And so we get an abundance estimate of each of these different prey types. We also, since we get our hands on the fish, we can take measurements of them, get diet information out of them, look at the different species. This is long-fin smelt, these more transparent guys. These are juvenile sockeye salmon here. Here's a bucket full of both, and then there's also mice and shrimp here as well. So you've got a number of different players in the aquatic community there. Okay, then you get quantitative data like this, where we have the lake that's divided into different regions. We have five different reporting regions, and then we can, by different depth intervals in the water column, we can estimate what the density of these fish are. This is density of fish along this axis here. And by combination of the hydroacoustics and the netting, we can partition those into different species. Primarily, we want to look at the sockeye fry. These are the black bars here. And you'll note that most of the sockeye fry during March are down toward the south end of the lake, but they are dispersing partially up toward the north end. So it's not the worst case scenario of them all clustering down here. So that was an important result in and of itself. We also need to know something about the prey resource. What are the zooplankton doing out there? We sample them in various locations to get densities of them. And then here's the punchline of this modeling. Rather than going through all the steps, what I've done is I've modeled what the consumption rate of the sockeye fry population was on a monthly basis, and then I'm relating that to the biomass of the primary zooplankton species out there. So it's a ratio of how much was eaten relative to how much was available. Okay, so the lower this value, the better off this population, the food supply is. They're eating a smaller fraction of the food supply. And so we can go month by month through this critical period, and we can see that the demand relative to food supply increases most during March and April, and then drops off in May. Even under the word, we've got a bunch of different scenarios listed here, just in case conditions change beyond what we observed. And we note that I've circled what are the most logical cases based on the information that we, both the distribution of the fish and their feeding rates. So the fish distributed from Renton all the way past Mercer Island up to the 520 bridge, or in this case areas 4 and 5 just meant they dispersed from the south end of the lake all the way up to the I-90 bridge. And in this circumstance here, you're seeing that they're feeding at only about 7 to 12%. They're eating only 7 to 12% of the existing biomass of the edible zooplankton out there. Okay. Now, if conditions worsened, let's say they did stay only in Area 5, they still would only eat about 35% of the existing biomass under those 2 months where the conditions were most limiting. And sort of a nonsensical scenario was if they stayed down in Area 5 but there was also no mortality, which is impossible, then there'd be a lot more fry feeding on those zooplankton, and they still would only reach about 60% of the biomass that was available out there. So the bottom line in this particular application was that we concluded that the winter food supply was sufficient to support the fish, the current population of sockeye, as well as the proposed increase in sockeye that this hatchery plan envisioned. Okay, so the management implication was that we removed this major uncertainty. They could go on with the planning process. Doesn't mean that the hatchery plan was scot-free. It just meant that they no longer had to be concerned about food being a limiting element preventing this type of enhancement measure. However, there are some other concerns, and some of those were the interannual variability of zooplankton isn't very well understood, so you need to pay attention to that. Other planktivores could still create some trophic bottlenecks, not so much in the winter, but during other times of the year. And so that's worthwhile monitoring. And then climate change. We have a warming trend throughout in this lake over the past 30 years. And so that can change both the distribution patterns of the zooplankton and the fish, but also change their growth rates and feeding as well. So that's another monitoring concern that needs to be implemented into the adaptive management plan for any sort of a hatchery or long-term management of the resource here. Okay, another question in Lake Washington more quickly is looking at predation mortality on the juvenile salmon. And in this case, we're concerned about sockeye salmon again, but also Chinook salmon and Puget Sound in general on the endangered species list. And they either migrate through the lake over the course of a month, or they tend to rear for up to 5 months in the lake before moving out to Puget Sound. So we need to know whether or not predation is an important issue, and if so, get more information about what species of predators and what sizes of predators are imposing that predation mortality. What time does predation become most severe? Are there locations where that's a big factor? Essentially getting managers as much information as they can so that they can focus any sort of a management option down to just the times and places and targets that they need to. Again, here's the modeling process, but what we're trying to do is, because the predators have different sizes, we need to know what the size structure of that predator population is. Why? Because these smaller guys here are more abundant, but they don't eat as much. They also may have a different diet composition, so they may have a smaller proportion of fish in their diet, for instance. And so on balance, we need to know how this changes. And for each of these size classes, we get that consumption estimate, but now we can ramp it up to more of a population consumption estimate based on the size structure and the abundance of those predators. Also, if we know something about the biomass of the prey population, we can take that consumption rate and translate that into a mortality rate on the prey population. Okay, here's some inputs here. Stable isotope analysis, if you go up this axis, this is nitrogen, the stable isotope of nitrogen here. This indicates the higher up you go, the higher in the food web you're operating. Along this axis, this is the size of the predators here, and so I just want you to focus on cutthroat trout. As they grow, they become more and more predatory. Same thing with northern pikemen, which is the other major predator out here. Yellow perch were potentially a predator, and you see a slight trend there, but it's not nearly as strong. The other thing to look at is if we look at the carbon isotopes here, the higher the isotope level here, that means they're feeding more on either shore or bottom-oriented types of prey or even stream sources of prey. The lower on this curve they are, the more of an open water pelagic source of prey they're feeding on. And so if we integrate this, or if we look at this, we see that there is a trend towards feeding more on pelagic prey by cutthroat trout. A hint of that, but not nearly as strong for northern pike minnow. If we put this picture together, what it's telling us is that cutthroat trout tend to become more predatory and more predatory on pelagic fishes like juvenile sockeye salmon, longfin smelt, three-spine stickleback. And so there's some precedence for worrying about predation. Also, these boxes are actually diet information where we know the identity of the prey and how much, what proportion of the prey are in the gut. And you see that the diet, the amount of fish in the diet tracks along with that isotope data. Okay, these are nice to use in conjunction because diets, you can only look at the diet contents of an animal, and what it does is reflect maybe the last 12 hours or 24 hours of the feeding history of that animal. Oftentimes predators are not successful, and so oftentimes you don't see indications of predation when it actually occurs. So you'd like to have another signal to back you up there. The isotopes give you more of a six-month window of what the feeding history was instead. And so if you look at that, it tells you that, yes, they were feeding on fish. We're not missing anything by the diet composition information. So we can proceed. Again, hydroacoustics are good for not only quantifying the populations, but also looking at how their distribution changes through day and night. During daylight, these prey fishes try to avoid their exposure to predators, and so they'll either school in these intermediate zones to feed, or they'll stay down in these deeper, darker waters and then come up at dusk and night to feed instead. So it minimizes their exposure to food to predators, but they need to feed, and most of their food resources are in these upper layers, and so they need to balance that. And so this is sort of a cartoon of that, where during daylight hours you've got schooling. Highest density is the zooplankton up here, but these predators, this is the visual envelope that they can hunt through in relative terms. They can cover a lot of water in daylight areas. So these fish are taking measures to protect themselves by schooling or staying deep. At dusk, they come up and they feed, on the zooplankton. The predators have a somewhat reduced detection envelope. So these fish, even though they're not immune to predation, they're making the best of a bad situation. And so you can follow this through a day, dusk, night sequence to look at how the pressures are operating at different trophic levels differently. And this gets to that access issue I was telling you about earlier. There's plenty of zooplankton up here, but these fish have to have access to it. Okay, so they need to do some balancing in time and space. Okay, so you can, here's a quantitative version of that. The only thing I'll show you here is you can overlay that with the temperature profile through across steps, and you can use that to come up with the thermal experience of these animals are. Okay, other inputs for the model. Again, here's the size structure of the predators. Here's their survival rate from one year class to the next. So they're, you have many fewer of the older animals there. And then we've got their growth rate to feed the model. And so we can look at how consumption changes from one season to the next. This is consumption by small cutthroat trout. We see that these gray bars are mostly invertebrates. These colored bars are different species of fish. This green color is longfin smelt. This black is three-spined stickleback. Red is sockeye salmon, and the purple are the Chinook salmon. So those are the two species you're concerned with. So the bigger fish down here are eating more fish in general, and they're the ones that are having an impact on the juvenile salmon. The northern pike minnow are also doing some similar feeding on similar fish, but they're doing it in different seasons and different times. Note that they eat a lot during the summer, but their consumption rates drop off a lot during the rest of the year. They're a warmer-blooded animal, so they don't respond nearly as well to cold temperatures, and so their consumption rates go down. They're not nearly as important a predator under those circumstances. Okay, so we have the biomass of different prey that are consumed on different seasons by the predator population, the sizes of prey eaten by different sizes of predator, and what we see is that the predators are capable of eating prey up to 40% of their own body length there. So there are very few of these small planktivorous fish that are immune to predation. So we can take that into account to come up with a ledger sheet of what level of mortality is imposed for every 1,000 of these predators out here. So for every 1,000 cutthroat trout of that size distribution I showed you, almost 1% of sockeye are eaten. Doesn't seem like much, but all of a sudden if you bump that predation or that predator population up to 50,000, 100,000 individuals, which is reasonable, it gets these numbers up to 80, 90, 100% mortality. Okay, so this, even though we don't know what the abundance of these predators are, this gives the managers some sense of what that predation impact potentially is. And so in this case, the results were that the predators are definitely capable of regulating these prey populations. As I indicated, 50 to 100,000 of each of these predator populations could impose severe mortality. So if this predation mortality is important, what can the managers do? Well, first of all, they can assign loss in the correct place. You know, instead of saying, well, we don't know whether it's a habitat issue or whether it's mortality or they're stressed out going through the ship canal or something like this, now we can actually account for that predation loss. And even if you can't do anything about it, you can account for it. You say, this is the loss. We don't need to be doing more habitat restoration up here to try and account for it because it's going to be chewed up by predation here. The other thing it does is it identifies what size of predator, when during the year that predation was occurring, and potentially what the location is. And so that goes into whether you can prioritize a habitat restoration program or not, based on whether or not you're going to gain anything by doing some restoration efforts upstream, or whether you need to do something to mediate the predation issue, whether it's predator or competitor control to regain that balance. You may have to think about how the temperature and water quality modifies that predation interaction, etc. So these things can all come into play. And again, it allows the managers to focus. So we've applied this just in our own lab to a number of systems in Washington. We're underway in Puget Sound, Lake Washington here. In Alaska, we've been doing this out in the open ocean as well. Prince William Sound out through the Gulf of Alaska with salmon. A number of lake systems around the West. I had an example for Flathead. We clearly don't have time for that today. If you're interested at some point, I'd be happy to talk to you about it. And with that, I'll end it. Thank you.